Great, thank you. The marshal can call the court to order.
Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Cochran, Judge Gaitis, Judge Rodenberg, the Honorable Jean M. Cochran presiding.
Good morning. Welcome to the Court of Appeals. For the benefit of the recording, today is February 15th, 2022. The next case on our calendar today is A21-1315, Teamsters Local 320 versus Minnesota Judicial Branch. This oral argument is being conducted by Zoom today. I'm sure the parties are familiar with the Zoom platform. I'll just remind you that you each have 15 minutes for your initial argument, and counsel for appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. You can see that there is a timing mechanism in the grid view that will keep track of the time. Hopefully there won't be any technical issues, but if there is, I'll ask the marshal to stop the clock to make sure you get your full allotment of time. I'll also remind anyone who's viewing that the Court of Appeals is recording this oral argument, and no other recordings are permitted except with the express prior permission of the Minnesota Court of Appeals. So with that, we can proceed. I'll ask counsel to identify yourself and the party you represent at the beginning of your argument. And counsel for appellant, you can proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Judge. Kevin Beck, BECK, on behalf of appellants, Teamsters Local 320. Good morning. We're here today on a case about a denial, a district court's denial of a temporary restraining order or preliminary injunction stemming from a charge of an unfair labor practice for a failure to meet and negotiate in good faith. It's the appellant's position that the district court's finding as a threshold matter on irreparable harm is clearly erroneous and an abuse of discretion. The district court explicitly recognized that allowing the IFP pilot program at issue here to proceed would impact the party's bargaining relationship. It's appellant's position that Unilateral implementation of this IFP pilot program is a change to a term and condition of employment, and that by denying the TRO and allowing this program to move forward, the union's position is irreparably harmed and it can't be quantified. Their position in terms of their standing with their members, their position in terms of their bargaining relationship with the public employer, the judicial branch in this case, and their position with respect to bargaining power when they do get to the table. And to that end, the district court held, should the MJB be required to negotiate its policy with respect to IFP transcripts, the parties will have the benefit of information from the pilot program with which to negotiate. That's effectively giving the judicial branch an advantage in bargaining power through the denial of a TRO and allowing a change to a term and condition that changes the status quo to move forward without an injunction. The proper way to have addressed this issue in light of this recognition that it will impact bargaining power and bargaining relationship would have been to preserve the status quo, grant the TRO, adjudicate this case on the merits, let discovery flesh out the numerous discovery issues or factual issues that are addressed or are kind of warranted, and have a trial on the merits. First question, is this a change to a term and condition of employment?
So, counsel, I'd like to go back to the question of irreparable harm.
Sure.
I think the district court concluded that there wouldn't be any irreparable harm, but I thought I heard you say that the district court also concluded that it would impact the party's bargaining relationship. So can you explain to me exactly how are you arguing that the district court erred in its factual findings, or are you arguing an error of law? I'm not sure I'm exactly following your argument.
I believe, Your Honor, I'm arguing that both. And I should clarify that based on the wording of the district court's decision, it is tacitly recognizing an impact on the bargaining relationship. The district court held that there was no irreparable harm in it, really a sentence that basically said the cases cited by the local at the district court level were different than the cases finding irreparable harm to bargaining power and to unions from an employer's refusal to meet and negotiate in good faith were different. Therefore, there's no irreparable harm to the union. So I think that is an error of law in terms of not fleshing out the factual findings. And then the court specifically found that if appellant is ultimately successful at trial, this lack of a TRO and allowing this program to move forward will shape bargaining in the future. So in other words, even if it loses at trial, the employer will be able to reap the benefit of its unilateral imposition of this IFP pilot program when the parties are ordered to negotiate in a future date. That is, in my words, a tacit recognition that there is irreparable harm to the local, to the appellant, that warrants an injunction to be granted.
Does the record reflect that the judge found that it would be a benefit to the employer in the bargaining going forward, having this go into effect, the pilot program take effect? You're assuming that the benefit would be to the employer, I think, but I don't see a finding to that effect.
The way it was found was that it would be a benefit to the parties. The parties will have the benefit of information from the pilot program with which to negotiate. It's the union's position, appellant's position, that will be a one-sided benefit, that a program that was forced upon the union and its membership without any ability to negotiate over its impact or its implementation will not be a benefit to the union when that time comes, if that time comes. And a TRO or an injunction to preserve the status quo would preserve the status quo until we flesh out all of the factual and legal issues at this case and get an adjudication on the merits to determine the scope of bargaining, if any. It is certainly possible that after a trial on the merits, the employer is successful and the court determines either A, that this does not affect the term and condition of employment and is therefore not a mandatory subject of bargaining, or B, even if it is a term and condition of employment or a change thereto, it's an inherent managerial policy. And C, then that would get into the inextricably interwoven analysis. But all of that has to be done through a trial on the merits, and the purpose of a TRO and the purpose of PELRA and the express legislative grants to give an aggrieved party by an unfair labor practice the ability to seek and obtain an injunction to preserve the status quo is disrupted by the district court's order denying it. And it's important that the district court, in its analysis of likelihood of success, found this to be a close call.
Mr. Beck, as to this irreparable harm element, you did cite a fair amount of federal case law indicating that employers' actions on occasions have been found to create irreparable harm by affecting the bargaining relationship. But the cases that you cited seem to me to involve quite extreme conduct on the part of employers, employers refusing to bargain altogether, for example. Do you have, and there were a number of those cases, do you have a case that is a little closer in circumstances to the circumstances here that you can use to sort of hang your hat on for the irreparable harm element?
I don't, Your Honor, but I would take the position that it does not matter to a certain extent. And what I mean by that is whether it's, an egregious example of an employer refusing to recognize a union entirely, just flat out refusing to recognize them and acknowledge them, or whether it's a refusal to, or they recognize the union, but they refuse to sit down and negotiate a contract at all, is not any different from a legal standpoint of refusing to meet and negotiate with a union on an individual issue that they are required to meet and negotiate on. So for example, if the judicial branch, for example, had issued an order, so this particular order is specific to IFPs, transcripts for informa pauperis cases. If the branch had issued an order that said, effective October 1 of 2021, every transcript that is requested and that had been done prior to that outside of the court reporter's employment on an independent contractor basis will now be brought into the workday. They will do it during their work time. They will not be able to receive any independent contractor pay for it. And we are not going to meet and negotiate with the union on this policy, either before we implement it or to discuss impact. That's a more kind of egregious, broad refusal, right? This is no different. So if they do it piecemeal, should not excuse the unfair labor practice of failing to meet and negotiate. So simply, what I mean by that is an employer should not be able to chip away death by a thousand cuts, for example, at its bargaining obligations and then kind of rely on, well, the cases that have gone to trial or that have been adjudicated are these egregious ones. We're not as bad as that, so we should be allowed to do it. And then we incrementally work our way up to what effectively amounts to a complete refusal to meet and negotiate on a change to a term and condition of employment and an abrogation of their duties and obligations under PELRA. At the end of the day, the loss of collecting bargaining rights is real. The loss of the harm to the union and its ability to meet and negotiate changes to terms and conditions of employment is a very real, very irreparable harm. It cannot be quantified. The district court cited a little bit about, well, the impact, the financial impact to court reporters can be quantified. I would assert that that itself is a factual, is an erroneous factual finding, that the way that this program is set up, it's almost virtually going to be impossible to determine which court reporter should have gotten or would have been able to get which transcripts and how much he or she would have gotten paid for those. The one other issue I want to bring up.
I'm sorry to dwell on irreparable harm for so long, but I do have one more question for you. You know, the district court in its order analyzed the question under both the statute 185.13A and under the traditional analysis under Rule 65 of the Rules of Civil Procedure. In your reply brief, in your initial brief, I don't think you addressed 185.13A, and in your reply brief, you argue that it's that statute is inconsistent with 179A.13. And I'm just wondering if you can help me understand that argument, because my reading of 179A.13 subdivision 10 is that it expressly says nothing in this paragraph precludes a charging party from seeking injunctive relief in district court after filing an unfair labor practice. So it's not clear to me how the two statutes are inconsistent.
If you look at 179A.24, Your Honor, it is a specific adoption of sections 185.07 to 185.19. It's what it says. What 179A.24 says is that those sections in 185 apply to all public employees. And then I quote, except as sections 185.07 to 185.19 are inconsistent with 179A.13. So to the extent that there's any argument that 185 is a blanket prohibition or precludes injunctive relief in a labor dispute, it is inconsistent with the terms of PELRA and 179A.24's kind of essentially preemption of the Anti-Injunction Act.
But how is it inconsistent with 179A.13? That's what I'm having trouble understanding.
The appellant argued that 185 effectively bars an injunction in labor disputes, and that's not the case. 179A.13 specifically allows an aggrieved party to seek an injunction in district court, and 179A.24 reinforces that, and it clarifies that the Anti-Injunction Act, if there's any inconsistency, if there's any reading of the Anti-Injunction Act to eliminate labor disputes in the public employment context, you know, 185 is a lot broader. It applies to both public and private labor disputes. 179A is a much more specific statute to public employers and public employees and clearly allows a party to seek an injunction. So the inconsistency would be any argument that 185 precludes or prohibits injunctive relief in a labor dispute, 179A overrules or supersedes that.
Thank you.
In the last minute and a half, I just want to touch briefly on the inconsistency from the judicial branch on this issue. It's brief, so I won't use up all of my time, but effectively, when it suits the branch argues that this work is outside of the contract, not subject to bargaining. Now that the branch has changed its mind, it is not only inside the contract, which is inconsistent with its prior position, but it's inside the contract and, the branch argues, an inherent managerial right that it controls exclusively. And that's simply not what the facts in front of the district court or the law would allow for. The parties have never treated this as inside the contract. The union, in fact, fought this in the prior arbitration and lost and accepted that and didn't try to negotiate it in or recognize that the arbitrator found that this was outside of the labor agreement and therefore would stay out there. If we had stayed there, wouldn't be an issue. We wouldn't be here. But the branch made the decision to bring this work into the confines of the workday, into the confines of the collective bargaining agreement. And because of that, they must meet and negotiate those changes. That's why the appellant has asked that this court reverse the district court's decision as an abuse of discretion and or clearly erroneous in denying the injunction and issue an injunction to preserve the status quo pending a trial on the merits. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for respondent, you can proceed when you're ready.
Thank you. May it please the court, Jason Marisam for the Minnesota Judicial Branch. We ask this court to affirm the district court's denial of the injunction because there was no abuse of discretion. The district court correctly found that the merits favor the judicial branch and there's no irreparable harm. And a finding on either one of those factors, they found on both for the judicial branch, but on either one is a sufficient reason to deny the injunction and there was no abuse of discretion. Before I turn to the merits, I want to provide some context of what this pilot program does and doesn't do and why it exists. So generally, when parties request transcripts from the court reporter prepares them and the parties pay them as contractors, independent contractors, not through their employment in the judicial branch, but as independent contractors. There are two basic exceptions to this. One is when a judge directs the court reporter to prepare the transcript. That work is done by the court reporter as part of its employment for the judicial branch during normal business hours. The second exception that's relevant here is that if the party has IFP, informa pauperis status, and they request the transcript, the state pays for it if it's approved. So the court, the judge will review that request. And if the judge approves it, issues what's called a supplemental IFP order, approving the request and authorizing the state to pay for it. So we have a very unique situation here where when you're dealing with IFP transcripts, you have court reporters who are employees of the state and paid by the state, who are then also paid by the state as independent contractors to prepare the transcripts. So the IFP pilot program was set up to see, is there a more efficient use of taxpayer money here, a more efficient way to prepare these transcripts? Do the court reporters have time during the day, during their normal business hours, to prepare these transcripts as part of their normal employment with the court? So we set up a one-year pilot program to figure out if it works. And so with the
counsel,
pilot program—
The panel is, I think, very familiar with the record below. So I'd like to turn to the issues, the specific issues before us, and turn to the question of irreparable harm first. You know, that was the focus of a number of questions of appellant's counsel. But first, what is your view as to which standard is appropriately applied, 185.13A or Minnesota Rule of Civil Procedure 65.02 or both?
Thank you. Well, first, we win under either one, but I think it's pretty clear that 185.13 applies. I did case research, couldn't find anything from this court applying it, but I think the statute is crystal clear on this point. 185.13 applies to the PELRA unless they're inconsistent. There's no inconsistency. PELRA says you can get an injunction And 185.13 lays out the factors you need to get that injunction. It is not our position and never has been that you can't get the injunction. The Anti-Injunction Act is a bit of a misnomer. It lays out the factors you have to show in order to get the injunction. I think under the clear text of the statute, it applies. They're not inconsistent at all. They're completely harmonized. One says you get an injunction. The other says, here's how you get it. Where this matters in the argument, if you look at the text of 185.13, where it seems to be a bit different than the normal injunctive standards, instead of likelihood of success in the merits, you actually have to show an actual violation. So it can't be just, I'm balancing, you're likely to success to show an actual violation. So I think that sort of ups the burden for the moving party there. The other
under,
is-
Under either standard, the irreparable harm showing is required.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. And it makes crystal clear the statute, though, that the statute only applies to labor cases. And it says you need to show irreparable harm. And that's a core weakness of their position. Their argument on irreparable harm combines the merits with the harm. They say, if there's a violation, voila, there's harm. Well, we have a statute that just applies to labor disputes that has the very concrete as separate factors. The second factor, there's no reason to have the irreparable harm factor if all you need is to show the violation. So I think that really undercuts their argument when they say just simply the violation itself is going to be the harm. It can't be. There's got to be something else there. The district court correctly summarized the law by saying the compensation piece is not irreparable harm. You're dealing with a one-year program. It ends. At some point, you can calculate what the money is. So what else is there? Their argument is the program changes the bargaining relationship. But as you pointed out, Your Honor, none of the cases come close to being close to this situation at all. There's no dispute that the union is recognized by the employer, that they bargain for and enter into collective bargaining agreements. And if the-
Can you address in that regard with, in terms of the pilot program going forward and it affecting future negotiations, can you address appellant's argument that that is really a benefit to the employer and the district court abused its discretion when it found that there wouldn't be any harm to the union or that the union hadn't, Teamsters will not suffer irreparable harm in the absence of a temporary injunction is what the district court found.
Right. So I think what the district court is saying at the end of the 1 year, if there were some violation, the monetary piece can be compensated. And then let's say what the union seems to be getting at is that just affecting the bargaining relationship has some harm and that the information only favors the employer. And I don't think that's right. If the pilot program were to be a disaster, for example, and then the employer still tries to make it a permanent non-pilot, but a permanent indefinite program, that's useful information that would cut against the employer, for example. And I don't think the district court made a finding one way or the other, but just to the point that there's usefulness to the pilot program to see if this is a good use of taxpayer resources, if there's a way to do this for the court reporters to be able to do the work during the normal hours to save some taxpayer resources, and how the pilot program works is relevant to the whole bargaining relationship about whether this should be permanent or not.
So Mr. Marisam, it seems to me that Mr. Buck is arguing that the MJB made a unilateral change to the employment of court reporters, and this may not be quite as extreme as what happened in some of the federal cases, but by effectively doing that, the MJB is undermining the union's ability to negotiate. And to pick up on Mr. Beck's expression, this is maybe death by a thousand cuts, and that's no better. I'm wondering if you could respond to that argument, please.
2 points. So first, it cannot be that everything an employer does is an irreparable harm because it affects the status quo in a way that it could affect negotiations. And so where's the stopping point under their argument that anything we do, of course, that everything the employer does arguably affects the relationship that exists. There has to be something more. That's why you see all the cases are, they're actually trying to destroy the union. They're actually trying to not recognize it and destroy it. That is a clear point. That's where all the cases go. This, the employer implements some sort of policy that's irreparable harm. And it's important to keep the merits separate from the harm. I do want to talk about the merits though, because that is a clear hurdle they need to get beyond. In order for there to be negotiation at all, the policy needs to affect a term and condition of employment. That is a defined term that is defined in the statute. And there are three parts to the definition. It either needs to affect the hours of employment, the compensation of employment, or be a personnel policy that affects the working conditions. On the hours piece, on the face of the order, it is clear there's no change in hours. The court reporters will do their work during their normal hours. If they need to prioritize certain work or not, that's just normal employment stuff. The hours aren't changed. On the compensation piece, it's important. The statute talks about compensation of the employment, and the employment here is with the judicial branch. And that compensation isn't changed at all. Their argument is that it might affect the weight, the amount of money they get as independent contractors for work they do outside their employment with the judicial branch. And the judicial branch has been entirely consistent that that independent contractor work, something that affects the hours or compensation for the independent contractor work, does not need to be negotiated over. The 2019 arbitration was about just that. The judicial branch had a policy that the court put in place, a policy that the court reporters could not do their outside contractor work during their normal business hours during the employment of the judicial branch. That was challenged in the arbitrator's side of the judicial branch. That was something that affected the hours for the court reporters doing their outside contractor work. And they said, you don't need to negotiate over that. Something that affects the hours of the outside contractor work is not part of the employment. Here we have something that might affect the compensation of that outside contractor work. Entirely consistent position by the judicial branch. We don't need to negotiate over something that affects the compensation of the outside contractor work. There is no argument that the core compensation of the judicial branch is being changed. And there's no argument that this is a personnel policy, which it obviously isn't. So we squarely do not meet that definition, the statutory definition of term and condition of employment. And so there is no obligation to negotiate over that. So both on the merits, there is no violation here, and on irreparable harm, but under either one, is sufficient basis for denying a preliminary injunction.
What are we to do with the district court's determination that actually on the merits, this is a pretty close call for our purposes? What do we do with that?
So 2 points. First, the district court found it was a close call, but favored the judicial branch. So it's not an abuse of discretion to deny an injunction when the merits favor the non-moving party. The second piece, this is where 185.13 comes in. The statute says you can't get an injunction in a labor dispute unless you show, quote, that unlawful acts have been threatened and will be committed unless restrained, or have been committed and will be committed unless restrained. It doesn't say how likely, how close is it? They have the burden of showing an actual violation. So under 185.3, a slight favor of the non-moving party is not enough at all. I do want to briefly, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. I was
going to change subject, so nothing I need to talk about, so go please.
Great. I was going to change subjects too. I was going to ask you about the last issue. Is that where you were going?
Yes.
Well, I'll go ahead and ask my question, and then you can follow up with any additional thoughts you have that you think we need to know. But you argue that that question of judicial bias is not properly before us because the motion to vacate wasn't decided, and what the issue or the order that's on appeal here is the temporary injunction order. So what rule of appellate procedure or case law do you think best supports your argument that this issue isn't properly before us on appeal?
The law I'm relying on is that a motion to disqualify, which they brought in the district court, is reviewed under an abuse of discretion standard. So it has to be a decision made at the district court that is reviewed for abuse of discretion. The union moved at the district court to disqualify the judge, put all the arguments out there that more or less all of them that they're making now, said hearing, date and time to be determined, never scheduled the hearing, never asked the court to decide it on the papers. So it's all right there. That it was never, they could have asked for a hearing. They could have asked for a decision on the papers and they didn't. So there was no decision by the district court on that motion. There hasn't been, as far as I can tell, it's still hanging out there. It's effectively moot because the judge is no longer the assigned judge. But procedurally, if they had wanted to tee that up for this court, they should have asked for a decision on the motion instead of just leaving it hanging out there. And so I would just point to the general rule of that motion to disqualify is reviewed for abuse of discretion. And it was on the union to make sure that there was some decision that could then be reviewed for abuse of discretion. And they took no effort at all for that to be decided. I also think for all the reasons, I've got 30 seconds left, but I think we thoroughly brief why substantively there is nothing there for any of the allegations regarding disqualification. They don't come close to meeting the burden that they would have to meet to show bias and disqualification.
Isn't it telling that a different judge was assigned about that same time?
The notice of stepping of recusal. Well, it's a bit complicated, Your Honor, because this case was initially assigned to a judge who the union used their automatic right to remove. Then it was assigned to another judge who then recused, then assigned to Judge Bernardson, scheduled for a hearing the day before the order went into effect. We had the hearing. She issued the order that same day in order to make sure that there would be law on the books before it went into place. And then the judge also issued a notice of recusal. The law from the Court of Appeals is that you can't read anything one way or another into that recusal without a decision on the merits of without some sort of explanation that's not entitled to a presumption that there is something there. I'll also point out that the fact that Judge Bernardson was on the Judicial Council long before this policy was put in place was public, was known. Clearly, the union had an idea of the judge they wanted. They removed the initial judge. And if they had any issues, they also could have raised it before, could have pressed their case in the district court to bring it up. The key part of the substance, though,
Counsel, your time has expired. Yeah. So if you can sum up briefly, we'd appreciate it. Thank you.
We fully briefed all that, and I'll stand by the briefing there. The bottom line, Your Honor, is that there was no abuse of discretion. The district court correctly found that the merits favored the judicial branch, and there was no reparable harm. And a finding on either one of those factors is sufficient under either standard. But we do think 185.13 clearly applies. But under either standard, we would win and ask for an affirmance. Thank you.
Thank you. Any rebuttal?
Briefly, Judge. Thank you. A couple of things. Appellate or counsel argued that the appellant takes a position that the violation is the harm, and I would respectfully disagree. The violation is the employer's refusal to meet, negotiate on a term and condition of employment. The harm is the impact that has on the union and the bargaining relationship, which is a directly in violation or a direct contradiction to the stated public policy of HELRA. And this is not a situation where the union is arguing that any action done by the employer has an impact on the bargaining relationship and is therefore an unfair labor practice necessitating a TRO. This is a very unique situation that has been litigated in the past through the contractual grievance process, and the employer took the position repeatedly throughout that process that independent contractor work is outside work over which the judicial branch has no obligation to bargain. The union accepted that. But then they brought that independent outside work, the employer did, into the workday and into the contract. And as soon as they did that, they have to negotiate that. you know, that this argument that it's just a pilot program to look at, you know, cost savings measures and good use of state funds, where does that end? Could an employer put together a pilot program to try to save money? We're going to reduce the wages of employees by $10 an hour. No, it's laughable on its face. This is not that much different. You are directly affecting compensation. And this is unique in this animal because the parties acknowledge, and they acknowledged in the arbitration award, that they negotiate court reporter compensation in the collective bargaining agreement in light of the fact that production of independent contractor work is out there and available only to official court reporters. But if the branch can exercise the authority whenever they want to bring it into the contract without additional pay, that's a problem that directly undermines the union's position and weakens its bargaining power and weakens its standing within its membership. This is not a random kind of pull out of left field. This is an issue that the parties have fought over. We thought we reached a conclusion that both sides could live with when we litigated it. And then 2 years later, the branch turns around and completely flips its position and says, no, wait, this is now our work that we can direct to you. We don't have to pay you for it. You're going to lose in your overall compensation structure that we recognize. You're going to lose money, but we're not going to negotiate on it. You have to do it during the workday. The argument that supplemental IFP orders on September 30th of 2021, when a judge signed a supplemental IFP order, it was considered ordering a transcript on behalf of a party that the court reporters did outside of the workday and received pay for it. Where that pay comes from is largely irrelevant, whether it's a state fund or a private party. But then the very next day, the court signed an order, and now all of a sudden, a supplemental IFP is an order by the court to prepare a transcript that a court reporter must do during the workday and cannot charge independent contractor rates. It's belied, and respondents brief, they acknowledge that that is still an order, quote, on behalf of a party. An order for a transcript on behalf of a party that has always been, since the inception of this bargaining unit, outside contractor work that an independent, that a court reporter is allowed to prepare outside of the workday and receive those independent contractor rates. The issue of whether it's a term and condition of employment, that's what we're here for. That's what this lawsuit is about. And that is what needs to be litigated and ultimately adjudicated on the merits after discovery, after trial. The union has simply asked that the status quo be preserved until we get to that point. That was the purpose of the TRO request. That's the purpose of a TRO to be granted. Metropolitan Sports Facility specifically acknowledges that even finding a doubtful showing as likelihood of prevailing on the merits, a TRO or a temporary injunction may issue to preserve the status quo. And that is the situation which we have found ourselves in today and in this litigation. For those reasons, we again request that this court reverse the district court, that it abused its discretion when it denied the TRO. Thank you.
Thank you for that rebuttal. I do have one question for you about the last issue, the judicial bias issue. In your statement of the case, you indicate that the order on appeal is the temporary injunction order. And after that order was issued, the union filed the motion to disqualify and vacate. So given that the order on appeal is the temporary injunction order that doesn't address the question of judicial bias, is that issue properly before us on appeal under our rules?
I believe so, Your Honor. It weighs directly on the decision. But to Judge Rodenberg's point, shortly after we filed that motion to disqualify, the judge recused herself without order or explanation, which in my opinion renders it largely moot, which is why we never scheduled a hearing or took any further action to get it moved forward. But I believe the time was the recusal came after I filed my brief.
May I follow up, Judge Cochran?
Certainly.
You know, to some extent, this is sort of a bottomless pit of bottom lines on potential conflict or bias. Senior Judge Smith, who replaced Judge Bernardson, was himself the first vice chair of the Judicial Council. I was on the Judicial Council for some years. Court reporter compensation generally has been talked about forever before I was on the Judicial Council and before I was even a judge. you know, anyone who's been a chief judge or an assistant chief judge, in fact, almost any district court judge who's ever had a confidential relationship with or for whom a reporter was a confidential employee, is everybody's to some extent impaired by some degree of bias. Where would it stop?
2 points, if I may, Judge. I know my time is out. First one is, that is the rub. Therein lies the rub with representing court reporters and having to go to district court, because there's always going to be a perception of bias. Second point is, unlike you and the other judges you've named, if we were allowed to flesh this issue out, which we didn't because Judge Bernhardtson removed herself, she served on the Judicial Council at a time 1 year prior to this policy being implemented, when they specifically discussed this policy. When she was on the Judicial Council, this very policy was discussed. It was tabled because of COVID, and then it came back up and was ultimately granted after she had retired.
Thank you for your responses, and thank you to both counsel for your helpful arguments. We will look carefully at the issues in this case and issue our decision within the statutory time period. Thank you.
Thank you, judges.
Thank you, Your Honors.